I'm Bridget from Balderstone Hornibrook. I've actually, Gary, you spoke a lot about challenges and challenges to the manufacturers. Got a challenge for Richard today. We've spent 18 months to try and sign up green energy for our construction company and without success. So got a challenge for Richard. Willing to sign us up?
I'm sure Richard will be able to talk with you after the session. Do we have any questions of Gary? Well, yes, we've got a question over here.
Graham Atkinson from a company called Silca. From your international exposure in your role, is there a country that's leading the way in terms of businesses' response to the carbon trading and how they manage their own power sources and diversity of supply and those sorts of things to optimise their position going forward?
I wouldn't say there's necessarily one country, but there certainly are pockets of leadership and activity where the carbon markets are flourishing. And remember, the carbon markets have gone from essentially zero 2 or 3 years ago to, in 2006, the World Bank found that there was $30 billion of carbon emissions reductions being traded, and they predict that there will be $60 billion traded in 2007. And if you look at the potential for the U.S. to get involved in those markets, or Australia to get involved in those markets, or Canada to get involved in those markets, places that have held back from the Kyoto Protocol and haven't participated as a result, you quickly can see the carbon markets becoming the largest commodity market in the world, which is obviously hugely significant. And certainly in Europe, in the United Kingdom, there's been a, I think, a flourishing of efforts to pioneer those markets and to develop experience with them. The European Union's emission trading system went on stream in the beginning of 2005. It's been really effectively about learning how these markets operate over the past few years. And remember, the Kyoto Protocol has emissions reduction requirements that don't even take effect until 2008. They're a five-year period, 2008 to 2012. And to have a flourishing market, even in advance of that, where people are essentially gaining experience and meeting host country domestic emissions reduction requirements, is a very impressive thing, and it's now an effective working market. And London has become something of a center for carbon finance, for doing the deals that make these emissions reductions possible. And there are now about 2,800 clean development mechanism projects that either have been approved by the United Nations or are in the pipeline. Many of them increasingly are being sourced in Asia. Emissions reductions in China, emissions reductions in, in India. And there are a range of projects from energy efficiency to hydroelectricity to capturing methane from landfills and coal mines to capturing waste industrial gases that may be highly potent, highly destructive greenhouse gases from manufacturing of fertilizers or refrigerants. And those projects are becoming very, very successful at the same time as there's beginning to build a set of voluntary emissions reductions, really for companies who, for one reason or another, decide that they either want to go carbon neutral or reduce their emissions as well. And I just caution that because there's even fewer standards around those kinds of projects, the risk may be even higher for companies and potential reputational damage around the quality of those projects as well, but a absolutely central piece.
We've probably got some more questions, but I just had one actually. Gary, on the basis of your presentation, you raised the prospect of litigation, and you said that it's becoming more common, and there are many actions at least being mounted in the United States particularly. It seems to me two things. You also talked about the need for public disclosure. It seems to me that would be an inhibiting. The prospect of litigation is really going to inhibit companies from publicly disclosing emissions is the first point. And I guess the second thing is that even though there may well be a lot of litigations being launched, what's the prospects of success? Have there been any successful litigants? Because it does lay open the whole question of attributing causation to the activities of one particular company or corporate entity.
Right. Well, let me start with the second part. There has been successful litigation that's been brought not against private entities
right.
for the consequences of their emissions, but successful litigation that's been brought against the government for its regulatory activities or its lack of regulatory activities. For example, I was on the airplane over, I was reading a decision which just came out of our Court of Appeals in the West, and this is our second highest level court in the federal system next to the Supreme Court. And what they found was that the federal government failed to adequately consider greenhouse gases as part and parcel of its evaluation of automobile emissions efficiency standards. And the amazing thing about their ruling was that they did that under general environmental review statutes as opposed to under a specific statutory requirement, so that now, at least under that ruling, any federal action that is major has to take into account greenhouse gas consequences as a central environmental consequence, regardless of whether there's a specific statutory directive to do so.
Mm-hmm.
So huge traction in those areas, limited success so far, although there haven't been a lot of cases that have gotten beyond the standing stage on, for example, asserting a claim against the automobile manufacturers for the consequences of their emissions under public nuisance common mm-hmm. law theories.
Mm-hmm.
And those cases now are on, which have been dismissed, there are three of those in the district courts, are on review because they were dismissed on the grounds that they presented political questions,
right.
not on the merits of whether or not there
arguments.
Was that causation, but on the grounds that they presented political questions. On the disclosure piece, you know, obviously companies can read that either way. Some companies may see the benefits of public engagement and disclosure. Others may feel concerned about it. I think that there is a risk or vulnerability around the failure to adequately disclose that has yet to be explored in litigation and is potentially both a separate litigation argument and potentially the basis for some D&O or shareholder derivative activity as well that we're obviously sensitized to as we counsel companies.
Okay, thanks, Gary. Do we have any final questions? No? Well, I'd like to then invite Richard Stevens, who's Director of Invitec, to come and propose the vote of thanks, Gary.
Welcome, Richard. Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure for me to be asked to propose the vote of thanks on behalf of CEDA and the delegates to Gary. I've sat listening to Gary's presentation, and I think he was sort of cruel in some respects. He took us to quite a dark place initially, and then started showing us that there was light at the end of this tunnel, talking about how business is becoming aware, how government is becoming aware, and actually people are starting to act. I thought the final point you made when you start referring to the whole aspect of assessing risk and the insurance angle of risk assessment and risk management was the real light, because this now is going to stimulate businesses who maybe are holding back to actually stand up and pay attention and to change what they're doing. So again, on behalf of CEDA and the delegates, Gary, thank you very much for an excellent presentation.